So they're deliberate breaking points built in, and that means that rather than being built to last, these things are so quickly produced for the market, then discarded, and then it starts again. And that massively actually contributes to our very, very dangerous consumption levels.
And that's kind of when I realized there's a fundamental flaw in the global supply chain, which is that there are millions of these women farmers, miners, waste pickers who are completely invisible.
It's about being educated enough to challenge the supply chain, to start working together. And this is a critical element of the cradle-to-cradle work, is to find the right partners, you know, is to collaborate with the right people.
This is the Oblique Life Global Goals Podcast,
discussing the challenges we face to reach the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals,
but more importantly, sharing the solutions inspiring us to get there. In the first episode, we defined consumption versus consumerism. And if I summarize that with just one takeaway, it is that we are confusing our needs with our wants. In this episode, we turn to production. The materials, energy, labor, and transport we use to produce goods have a huge social and environmental impact. For example, in our bid to move away from fossil fuels to renewable energy, solar power has become economically viable, which sounds great.
Until we learn that China still uses a significant amount of electricity from coal to produce photovoltaic panels.
Now take ubiquitous inventions such as plastics or PEAR and polyfluoroalkyl substances known as PFAS. These revolutionized manufactured goods in the 20th century. Think of stain-proof textiles, waterproof outdoor gear, pizza boxes, non-stick frying pans, and efficient fire extinguishers. They bring convenience and accessibility for the consumer.
Yes, but these resources damage our health or are difficult to break down, to the point some countries have banned them.
Ben, let's look at a simple cotton supply chain as described by Mark Sumner in The Economist.
Smallholder farm sells raw cotton to a ginner, often through an agent.
Ginner supplies huge global traders who amalgamate cotton from around the world.
Trader sells to yarn producers.
Textile manufacturer buys yarn and knits or weaves the fabric.
Dyers and finishers buy the fabric.
Garment factory buys the cloth and produces the finished item.
Brand buys finished product and sells to the public.
But producers are not likely to bear the cost of change in these cases, or many more, unless forced to. Our production system is broken.
Not only broken, the system is dangerous, even fatal. In the name of keeping costs down, worker exploitation is rife, and people take shortcuts at the expense of basic health and safety. Remember the collapse of the Raina Plaza building in Dhaka, Bangladesh in 2013, which killed well over 1,000 people and injured more than 2,500? And it wasn't the first or last of such incidents. Hazardous labor conditions, low wages, and poor benefits prevail, whether in the ready-made garment sector, electronics, or agribusiness. At the same time, automation is continuing to change production, with more skilled labor being required as a result. As we touched on in our introductory episode, the world's growing population and purchasing power are putting a strain on the Earth's finite resources. Every year, the Global Footprint Network records Earth Overshoot Day, the date when humanity's demand for ecological resources and services in a given year exceeds what Earth can generate in that year. In 2020, it was the 22nd of August, but we had more than 4 months left.
At the beginning of 2020, a flurry of attention reminded us that we had only a decade to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals, including number 12, sustainable production and consumption. There was earnest urgency, but also skepticism. The road to hell is paved with good intentions, after all. Yet COVID-19 has given us an opportunity to disrupt our supply chains. This episode is about taking a deeper and perhaps uncomfortable look into production and the challenges around using alternative methods and materials. But it is also about solutions that are increasing supply chain transparency or reducing supply chain translucency, as our producers like to call it, and greeting a world where we do 100% good rather than less bad. How can we shift to materials and resources that reduce pollution and are embedded in the circular economy? How do we protect workers all along the supply chain? How do we do this permanently? And importantly, how do we scale up these solutions? These are answers we're trying to find out. And to do that, Ben, I think it's time to introduce the speakers.
Yes, it is, my friend. So in this episode, we will be featuring the following guest speakers. First, we have Vera Holscher, lecturer in marketing from Royal Holloway, University of London. Vera, thank you for being here. And can you tell us a little more about yourself?
Yes, and thank you so much for inviting me on the podcast today. So my research mostly focuses on ethical consumption and also how we consume together in shared spaces. Most recently, I have published a paper together with my co-author Andreas Chatzidakis on the qualitatively different affordances of physical and digital spaces of ethical consumption. In the past, I have also co-organized the Life of Electronics conference with my co-host Rafa Font, where we looked at the entire life cycle of electronics, from conflict mining to sweatshop labor to, of course, their consumption and distribution, to then hopefully them being reused, but ultimately maybe recycled or only discarded, actually. And recently, I have also started a research project on nappies for babies. And as in one of the earlier events that Romy ran, Sean Sutherland said, "I can't believe that we haven't yet solved the nappy problem." And I very much resoundingly agree with her on that. And that is also something that I'm currently working on. Thank you.
Thank you for that introduction, Vera. Next, we have Brendan Rowan, Cradle to Cradle design consultant. Brendan, thank you for joining us today. Could you tell us a little more about yourself?
Thank you so much for having me, James, and ladies. The reality with the current state of affairs in our world is as you guys mentioned earlier, slightly problematic in terms of production. So what we do in the companies that that I have the pleasure of contributing to is to take manufacture and assess down to the parts per million for toxicity, removing that toxicity, looking at how to implement circular economy models in production, observing the energy use, whether that comes from renewables or not, looking at the water stewardship element, how we create value in our social fairness structure as well. So looking at the Cradle to Cradle certified products program is a clear signal that there is a good solution for some of the issues that we are addressing globally. As Vera mentioned, there's some interesting developments in the nappy industry. We have friends in Australia who've just they've been creating the compostable nappy insert for G nappies, for example. That is an example that there are actually solutions out there. So I'm very happy to join you today and discuss some of these great advancements and innovations. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Brendan. Last but not least, we have Ashish Gadnis, who is co-founder and CEO of BenQ, and who is also our official partner for this season, as you've probably heard in episode one. So, Ashish, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Great. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. So I run a for-profit, for-purpose software company called BenQ, and we solve one of the most fundamental problems in the global supply chain, which is there are millions, or if not billions, of people who are sourcing today as smallholder poor farmers, especially women, your coffee, cacao, your barley, or are picking up your bottles and plastic yogurt cans on the street, yet are completely invisible in those supply chains. So what we've done is we've built an end-to-end supply chain system that enables brands to have traceability, transparency, but most importantly, equity in these supply chains so that these people who are marginalized are now visible. Over.
Wow, amazing, Ashish. I'm so excited to be speaking with all of you today. Rami, how about yourself?
I'm equally excited. And I think it's time just to get this get the questions going. So let's start with Vera. Vera, we often get fixated on the consumption side of consumerism, but forget that these products come from somewhere and involve people, resources, land, electricity, transport, and packaging, along with many other things. How does the producer drive consumerism?
Thank you for that question. So I have two parts really for that answer. So the first part, of course, is marketing. Now, I'm a marketing scholar, so this is also something that I study and I teach, how marketing is actually driving consumer wants, making them almost seem like consumer needs. And when we think of classic marketing, we think of, you know, always a new iPhone before your old iPhone has even ceased working. Or it can be about a new edition of limited sneakers, etc. So there's always this kind of urgency. You have to consume now. This is going to sell out, or you want to stay ahead of the curve, etc. So this, of course, is one very powerful mechanism which producers use to really turn on consumption. But there's another one, and that happens at the production stage itself. So Annie Leonard, she's the executive director of Greenpeace USA, of course. She founded The Story of Stuff in 2007. And this is a 20-minute animation that I can recommend to anyone who hasn't already seen it. Probably my fellow speakers have. And it's about how production actually builds in the breaking point in these devices. So it's not only just marketing, but it's also that devices and apparatuses are actually made in a way to break prematurely, and that's called planned obsolescence. So there are deliberate breaking points built in, and that means that rather than being built to last, these things are so quickly produced for the market, then discarded, and then it starts again. And that massively actually contributes to our very, very dangerous consumption levels.
Thank you for that, Vera. Yes, I feel like any audio visual device that I've ever used like crashes well before, but there's 3 to 4, maybe 5 year period where it's like it dies immediately.
It always breaks just after the warranty expires.
Exactly.
So you're like, okay, great. I'm going to go buy the new device now.
Yeah. All right. So companies are looking to sell their products at the highest price and make them at the lowest cost. You know, we know that they're constantly churning out new models and deliberately, you know, like, as you said, they build in the planned obsolescence. So take three all-pervasive consumer sectors, electronics, fashion, and food. Brendan, what are the major issues of our current model of production?
Good question. It's as you mentioned there, there's three tiers to this, but it's a multifaceted issue structure, really. I think when we look at production or manufacture of goods, as Vera so rightly mentioned, the aim is not necessarily generally to make a really good product that'll last for a long period of time. It's to create something which the manufacturer and distributor and company will benefit from the profit, which is all fair and well. And I'm a vehement capitalist, but also a vehement and passionate proponent of being responsible for those materials. So I think that's one of the things that we can start looking at, is taking responsibility for all of the unintended consequences or the impacts of managing and manufacturing those materials into products. Looking at a system, for example, like let's take Vera's example, the nappies. We can have a situation where, like G nappies, for example, they produce an outer layer for the insert to go into, whereas the insert then absorbs all of the material and the biological material and matter, which can then be discarded and composted. But the outer layer is then kept ad infinitum because it's made really well. Also things such as lighting units. Lighting is a big issue in electronics these days. And everyone's looking to make it a cost-effective strategy. What Philips has done is take responsibility for their materials. So they make them really well. And their business model is particularly geared around us renting lumen or lux, as we call it. So light as a service, as opposed to us having to buy the actual units and fittings and fixtures. So these circularity models, I think, are there. They're available. I think some of the problems in terms of the production is education and what the options are of improving sustainability standards and being socially fair. We need to bring that into context, and I'm sure we'll hear from Ashish around this. We really need to look at how we treat the people that are working in those environments, say that Cradle to Cradle has an approach to defining what social fairness really is.
And like you said, it's like you need to walk that fine line between being a capitalist yet being a sustainable producer. Speaking of Ashish, can we bring you in? Where do you see the major issues are in production?
I think the biggest issue, honestly, is greenwashing, right? Which is at the brand level and as well as at the consumer level. And the easiest example is you can walk into a New York coffee shop, pay $12 for a latte that says fair trade Congolese coffee, and you feel good about it. Your brand feels amazing about it. They get an award, but you don't realize that there is a mother at the other end of that coffee bean that is completely unbankable. She can never prove her existence in your coffee supply chain. And most importantly, if a war breaks out and she's moved out of Congo and now sitting in a refugee camp in Rwanda, her entire life is reset, right? Which means at no given time, these artisanal miners, smallholder farmers, or your waste pickers who pick up bottles and plastic cups, and we feel great that we're recycling, are not only invisible, but they can't even prove their existence in the supply chain. Yet everybody is greenwashing, saying, hey, we can tell you who our farmer is and tip your farmer. And my challenge to the brands and the consumer is to ask the question, does that really make any sense if you actually don't know who the farmer is and you've not been able to step change their livelihood? So I think that's the most fundamental issue in supply chain is the lack of equitable traceability and transparency. Over.
Thank you for that, Ashish. Yeah, actually, Rami raises that issue of greenwashing quite a bit, and it's pretty much one of the main reasons why we actually started this podcast. So Vera, we're going to go to you now. Where do you see the major issues in production, and do you think it is realistic to expect producers to help temper consumption?
Yes, I do think it is realistic for producers to help temper it. So I just wanted to bring in a statistic. So in 2019, Europe had the highest per capita e-waste production with 16.2 kilograms. Those numbers are from Statista. And what I think is really crucial about that is that those aren't, of course, only the end consumer products, right? So we're before talking about laptops. So for instance, you were saying that you have like the typical lifespan of one of your laptops would last for, say, up to 4 or 5 years, but probably you don't throw them away. Probably they're lying around somewhere at the moment. Same with the phones. So this huge number is massively contributed to by how industry is using electronics and how it's also wasting electronics. So recently, actually, I found the book Junkyard Planet by Adam Minter, ironically, in a secondhand bookstore. And he talks about how the secondhand market is actually a circular economy in its own right. And I think this is one of the ways in which, of course, as consumers, we can act to really kind of curb our consumption of goods, but also for producers to really think about how can we actually create something that has a much higher, longer use value. Another way would be to look at, for instance, concepts such as the sharing economy to borrow and rent rather than own. However, we must be very, very careful with that, because that very quickly can lead into the gig economy with very unfair employment, with no holiday pay, etc. So my colleague, Professor Gianna Eckhart, who's also at Royal Holloway still currently, she has done extensive research around the sharing economy, and she has said that there is no such thing as a purely ethical consumer. As a matter of fact, Savini, one of her co-authors, and another couple of colleagues in 2010 brought out the volume, The Myth of the Ethical Consumer, where they actually talk about how the motivation for consumers is often to save money, really, rather than trying to be an ethical consumer.
Avira, I think you've raised some really interesting points there. And what's coming out of all three of your responses is there's a real focus that needs to be put on the supply chain. And I think COVID-19 really unearthed how broken our supply chain is and how much we need to change it. So let's start with some of those problems. Ashish, you've worked in and around supply chains across various different countries and sectors. What are the biggest challenges you are seeing?
Thank you. I think the two big challenges we're seeing is the heightened increase in child labor and gender inequality. And two specific examples, if you see the recent reports that have come out in the last 6 months, 2 million children have been pulled out of schools in Africa and Latin America and pushed into child labor. Because, you know, supply chains have gone from just in time to just in case. And so the brands basically have set aside the impact piece away and said, we need to focus on securing our supply chains, which means that's the first thing where people compromise and push children into child labor. You know, the iPhone's a good example. And then the second one is gender inequality, right? Women are smarter than men. We already know that. Yet in this pandemic, what we're seeing is women are being given less visibility in those supply chains. So they don't have access to good credit, don't have good access to tools, you know, in terms of farming and things like that. So I think the two big challenges that we've seen in the last 6 months is the increase in child labor and gender inequality.
Thank you for that, Ashish. And I think there's a very important point. What about Vera, focusing more on the problem of labor exploitation and, I hate to use a phrase, but modern day slavery? How deep rooted is this issue in our production cycle? You've already just, you touched about it, you know, like talking about the gig economy and how we have to be careful about moving to a gig economy and the challenges that poses. But I'd love to hear your thoughts about the issue of labor exploitation and modern day slavery in our production cycle.
Sadly, it is actually very, very deeply rooted. And I think the term modern day slavery really does exemplify it very well, because when we think about slavery, we think about colonial times. And what we disregard in that way is that currently we have more people living in slavery than we did back then. And this is something that most people are not actually aware of. When I tell my undergraduates that kind of thing, they're absolutely shocked. So also, when we think about modern day slavery, we tend to look towards the global south. And past events such as, for instance, the collapse of the Rana Plaza that you cited also in the introduction. But we also need to look at each of our own domestic contexts. So, for instance, I'm currently located in the UK. And in the UK, we have a wonderful charity called Stop the Traffic. And at one of their events that they held at Royal Holloway, the university I work at, they said that the greatest source of domestic slavery is actually marijuana. It's pot growing. And people don't know that. You know, it's like, oh, it's a bit of a little alternative drug, etc. But it really isn't. A lot of people are actually illegally trafficked into the UK. They have their passports taken away from them. They don't speak the language. Then they're hidden away, kind of almost in a prison-like state, in say terraced houses, and they're growing pot. And some of them live there for very, very long periods of time before it is actually found out that there's a trafficking issue.
We're already touching on some really important issues here. I mean, we had Ashish talking about the gender and child slavery and child labor issues. Vera, you're talking about, you know, this idea of this modern slavery definitely does exist. Brendan, what about the environmental impact of our current system and the materials that we are using? How much has this been exposed during the COVID-19 pandemic in our supply chain?
Yeah, really good question, and thanks for highlighting some of these issues, both Ashish and Vera. Environmentally, I think the potential for augmenting, the chemistry element in terms of how we're polluting our waterways, how we're polluting the environment itself, forestry departments and so forth have been reporting a lot less activity or negative impact in the environment, not only here in the UK, but also in Europe, in the States, and globally, to be fair. So yes, I think the environmental impacts, particularly with observing the impacts of diminished activity in terms of production and movement around the planet, signal a very clear and identifiable need for us to augment the way that we behave towards the environment and how we can support that. So I think the COVID situation has definitely highlighted potentially positive move towards changing our behavior in terms of production and how we engage with taking responsibility for some of the nefarious chemicals that are out there in terms of our manufacture. And of course, we enjoy walking in parks, we enjoy going to natural environments, and that brings us a certain amount of mental and physical well-being. So celebrating those aspects, I think, is quite a critical element to be highlighted in treating the environment a lot better than we have been.
Yeah, it's COVID has definitely shown a light on, the damage that is being caused to the environment. So, Brendan, this is the perfect time to introduce Cradle to Cradle. Can you share with our listeners what your organization does and what you are trying to change?
Absolutely. So, Cradle to Cradle has been around for about 25 years now. It stemmed from a book that was published back in 1992 called The Hanover Principles, A Design for Sustainability, written by William McDonough and Michael Braungart. Years later, they then got together and developed the system that's now called cradle-to-cradle design or cradle-to-cradle products innovation. The platform came together with them writing a book called Cradle-to-Cradle, Remaking the Way We Make Things. To quote some of the wording there, the treatise is all about doing less bad and more good. And the context there for us in terms of Cradle to Cradle is looking at how to actually just do more good and not doing less bad. So the intention is to mitigate the behaviors of manufacturers and producers to be able to make healthy products, not just products that are a little bit less bad. So really going down to the parts per million to assess products, manufacture processes, and social upliftment in that arena.
Thank you very much for that, Brendan. I think I must say to any listener out there, if you haven't read the book by Cradle to Cradle, Remaking the Way We Make Things, I definitely recommend it. It's a fantastic book and it taught me so much and it shed so much light to me. And I guess, when I look back at the book and some of the takeaways I had, a disquieting running idea, which you've already actually alluded to, is that we've developed this narrative to be less bad. This is completely the wrong mentality and results in poor design, summing up where we are today, accepting being less bad rather than 100% good. Can you elaborate and share examples of where this has led us?
Absolutely. It's, the one big thing that we've been working on, and this is something I'm quite passionate about, is, we have this intention with, back in the 50s, with protecting people with fire retardant, for example. A great invention to make sure that, all our bedding and so forth, all the materials that we're surrounded with, even our clothing and the couch covers and the linens and the beds, all have this fire retardant coating because, we want to be protected. But fundamentally, what's happened is that much of the fire retardant that's created has up to 7 heavy chemicals in it, which are known to be endocrine disruptors and carcinogens. So the unintended consequence of that is a rise in cancer and, genetically disruptive outcomes, which is really unfortunate. But the reality is that the intention was never to harm people. It was to protect it. And that's kind of the notion in terms of being less bad. Is it how do we augment that chemistry to be just good? So Cradle to Cradle Products Innovation Institute has gone to assess particular fire retardants by a company called Burnblock, and they have now a Cradle to Cradle certified gold standard fire retardant, which can be added to different methods of production. So, we're across the board in terms of manufacture, of all the things that we come into contact as human beings, is a critical element to how we augment that perception. So just do good, not less bad.
And I love that. And I guess that kind of, that starts the thinking of, what are alternative methods and systems of doing it? Because yes, in theory, it makes absolute sense. Let's just do 100% good. Let's do the good and not less bad. But can you share some light into how we can adapt our thinking and processes to actually make this a reality and not just, some utopian idea?
Yeah, sure. I think, as we may understand, and some of our listeners will attest to, the fact that, we don't go out into the world intentionally wanting to harm anybody, right? But we never really, for example, when we looked at a couple of companies like Dystar, back in the 30s and 40s, there was never really a conversation about the impacts of making dyes healthy or non-nefarious. It was the performance elements of these dyes, for example, we want to have fixed color, mustn't wash out at 80 or 60 degrees, and must perpetuate without leaching onto the skin when people sweat. So there were a number of those criteria that were delivered to these chemical companies, and that's what they did. They made that. And now we're looking at the same companies completely augmenting their production to facilitate healthy dyes and healthy materials with non-toxic ingredients in them, because the companies have gone to them and said, well, now we're looking to change this. We're trying to impact our environment less negatively. So let's work together to augment this chemistry. And the companies like Dystar said, well, yes, absolutely, we can do that. They were never asked that in the first place. So it's about being educated enough to challenge the supply chain, to start working together. And this is a critical element of the Cradle to Cradle work, is to find the right partners, is to collaborate with the right people. And now customers are looking, the younger generation are looking to demand these things are resolved. There's a big push and pull reaction in the market to make healthy stuff, to make good stuff, to make more good and not just less bad, right?
Brendan, you mentioned cradle to cradle. Could you share some examples of how you are making a difference?
I think it's an overarching question, and thanks for asking that, Ben. The fact that we're looking at, you know, assessing the things that we utilize as human beings, you know, both in construction and the fashion industry, cradle to cradle, just to be clear, doesn't really address the food elements. That's not the kind of responsibility. But it's very much about looking at the manufacture processing and delivering that as an upsell, as it were. Working with companies across the board, so from fashion to construction to any kinds of materials that we come into contact with, the modality of what cradle to cradle offers is a holistic approach. It's scientifically based, biologically based, proven and evidence based strategy to make products healthier than what they have been. Examples could be, Vera, we can touch on the nappies again. The fact that the insert itself is cradle to cradle certified and can be composted, possibly not in local compost, but it mitigates the impact of these gel nappies going to landfill, for example. There's a product that we're currently working on called the Wonder Ween. It's a plastic tool. The plastic is made out of Eastman Tritan 2001 TX, which is a cradle-to-cradle certified gold plastic. So its properties are, the material health is really, really high. I think they've got platinum certified material health on that particular plastic. So the plastic itself is inert. If it goes into biology, it's not intended to, but if it does go into any biology, it's not going to cause any disruption to the endocrine system or is non-carcinogenic. And the process of that eliminates the Wonder Ween basically is a macerator that pre-mashes food for babies to wean on, so that those sort of 18 months that they want that pureed or softened food, this macerator helps with that, and that's generally used when parents cook their own food. So, you know, if you're cooking your food, you can include that nourishment for your baby, and it eliminates having to go to the shops and buy plastic pouches of food, of which I think about 1.8 billion of those plastic pouches land up in UK landfills every year. So, you know, I could cite plenty of these amazing triumphs in industry with cradle to cradle, but I guess we don't have that much time.
Yeah, I think we need a whole season for that one, Brendan. We need a season dedicated to cradle to cradle and the solutions. No, we'll be coming back to you shortly, but I want to go to Ashish now. And Ashish, I must say, there's so much talk in our society about technology being the future, the technological revolution is going to save things. And sometimes I sit there and think, is technology helping? And then I came across BankU, which is your company, and I was like, yes, finally, there's a company that's using technology to do something real, to do and solve a problem that needs solving. It's incredible what you're doing. It's inspired me. You're using data, technology, and purpose to solve one of the biggest issues in the production system, which we've touched on, which is transparency. So Ashish, why don't you share with the audience and listeners, why you started BankU in the first place, what you're striving for, and how greater transparency can really improve supply chains?
Absolutely. Thank you. So I actually started BankU because I got into a fight. I sold my last startup in 2012. Very fortunate I got out of poverty in India, came to the U.S., sold my last company. And in 2013 and 2014, I became a volunteer CEO for USAID in the Congo, of all the places. And, you know, as a volunteer CEO of a large NGO, which is USAID, I was working with smallholder farmers, artisanal miners in terms of, you know, supply chains, right? Because that was my background. What was interesting is I got into a fight end of 2014. Because one of the mother farmers wanted to open a bank account. And, you know, I've said this many times before, women are smarter than men. So for me, it was this incredible moment where this is awesome, this mother can be bankable, now she can prove her existence. But when we got to the bank refused to let her open a bank account. And even though she had multiple identity cards from the United Nations, she was participating, in a microfinance loan program, yet she was unbankable because she was a woman and she couldn't prove her history. And the guy said, look, I can't bank her, but I'll bank you. That's where the name comes from. If you're wondering what does bank you mean? And that's kind of when I realized there's a fundamental flaw in the global supply chain, which is that there are millions of these women farmers, miners, waste pickers who are completely invisible, yet they have different programs, getting to them. And that's when I realized, what if we use technologies like blockchain, no cryptocurrency, in a way that every time the mother sells a bag of coffee or cacao or a waste picker in Zambia, Lusaka, is going to bring in that bottle or that plastic can via SMS, so not dumping more technology at poor people, via SMS, you can guarantee the price, the quality, the weight, and now they have this history that makes them visible, which I call the economic passport. So, Bengu does something very, very simple, and that was the roots, which is really that mother farmer or that mother waste picker now, through an SMS message, has a detailed history of every piece of material she has sold in the supply chain, which we consume, right? So the beer, the jeans we wear, the coffee we drink, or every time we throw out a yogurt can. And, that's kind of our vision that we started back in 2016, is to use technologies like blockchain at its core, which is very simple definition, and I'll stop after this, which is people who participate in a transaction should get an equal copy of the transaction. And that element is what creates equity, which is that mother can prove, hey, I exist in the AB InBev supply chain because I grow your barley that makes it to a bottle of beer. Over.
And I think that's just an incredible solution, honestly, really. And you know what? I love the name as well, Bank You. Now, can you share some of the successes that you've had with Bank You already? I mean, look, you are, like you said, you're a relatively new company, but you've already managed to make some pretty good headway and supporting some really important solutions across the world. Can you share some of those with our listeners, please?
Absolutely. Yes, we've been extremely fortunate. We're coming up on a 5-year mark here, and we are today live and operational, so not a pilot, not a proof of concept, commercially operational in 41 countries, and almost 600,000 people in the last mile, first mile, are using our network. And I'll give two very specific use cases of success. One is AB InBev, everybody knows Budweiser. And one of the interesting things that they made a commitment was that all of their farmers will be skilled, connected, and financially empowered. Same thing on the recycling side. So they use us in 6 countries across thousands of farmers and waste pickers or recyclers in a way that they know who the mama farmer is on the Uganda-Sudan border, for example, or they know who the waste picker is on the streets of Colombia and Bogota. And this allows them to not only have a traceable and transparent system, but remember, every transaction starts building this economic passport for the last mile, first mile. So that's one big success story. The second one is with Japan Tobacco. I've spoken before about child labor, and a lot of companies look at child labor and then they'll do a report or they'll bring in an after-the-fact survey. At the end of the day, you're not solving the problem, because if you don't know where the child is during the harvest cycle, then you've actually missed the point. So Japan Tobacco started working with us 2 years ago, where now across 4 countries, the actual school attendance system is connected to blockchain, completely secure and private. But now the farming family, the agronomist, and the brand know where these children are so that they can take action if they see issues around child labor. And one quick example, the third one, which I forgot, was around COVID. In April, we started working with the Islamic Development Bank, and now they have rolled us out in 25 countries to ensure that the COVID supplies are actually getting to some of the most poor people in the world in Sudan and Mali and Mauritania, because those are the people who are typically left out in a pandemic like we're facing right now. And now we're gearing up for a vaccine rollout, a confirmation at the individual level. Over.
Thank you very much for that, Ashish. And it's just fantastic, because we talked about in the introduction about the challenges on the production side, how it's the labor side, it's the transparency, and it's the product. And having Brendan talking about the cradle to cradle solutions and you with BankQ, it just gives me so much hope that we can change the tide and we can create a system that is much better. If you are new to the series, you might not know, but together with Tree Points, an incredible company that is helping offset our carbon footprint, we are committing to offset 100 kilograms of carbon dioxide for every 100 listeners that tune in to the podcast. That's right, 100 kilograms of CO2 for every 100 listeners. So please do get your friends, family, and colleagues to join and subscribe so we can offset as much CO2 as possible. You mentioned, Ashish, that you created BankQ to help bring millions of people in developing countries out of poverty. In our current linear economy, brands are making tidy profits, but at the other end of the supply chain, the individuals are being exploited. From your experience, how do we create more equitability between the global north and south?
That's a great question. I think the way to create equitability between, you know, the global north and south is at two levels. One is recognizing the value of the transaction at the absolute last mile, right? And I'll give a very, very specific example. We met this woman farmer on the Uganda-Sudan border who, before BankQ, had gotten a paper receipt. And that paper receipt basically told the world that, hey, she sold barley. But it rained and the paper receipt disintegrated. And, you know, this is public case. I shared very openly. And she had to wait for 4 days to get paid. That's just unfair on all levels, right? Fast forward, where we have kind of shown now that that can change and bring the two worlds together is that AB InBev, you know, Budweiser, most people know them as, is now using BankQ with that mama farmer. So that receipt is via an SMS message in the local currency, right? Ugandan shilling. So she starts building this history that says, I've sold 40 kilos at 16% moisture or whatever the parameters might be. And because she now has this contiguous history, today she has a bank account, she has crop insurance, and she uses mobile money to pay for school fees, right? And for me, that is the probably most critical example of showing how we, as you know, the North, if you may, can actually connect to the South, not from a pity lens. Nobody needs pity in the world. That mama farmer, all she needed was this dignity, which is saying that I am a good farmer and she's equal to us. So that's how we need to solve the problem, is by taking a commerce approach, but an equitable commerce approach. Over.
Thank you very much, Ashish. And it nicely touches what Vera was mentioning earlier when we were talking about, you know, sometimes about the exploitation of labor and making sure that we do value all levels of a chain and pay the fair wage and the fair, and they get the fair opportunity that they deserve. The second question I had to you was, whose responsibility is it to make these changes? Because you touched on the fact that, okay, fine, in this situation, AB and Bev, they invested in your software, and because they did that, you were able to build this transparency in the supply chain for them. But if we take a wider lens and look at the rest of the world, whose responsibility is it to make these changes and to ensure that that equitability is a given and not a question that we're trying to solve?
In terms of whose responsibility it is, you know, I would answer it in two parts. One is, before they answer that question, they have to ask themselves, do you want a profitable business that is driven by purpose, right? If the answer is no, then all of these discussions are useless, right? Because I know a lot of CEOs that'll go nameless who will say they want to end child labor in the cobalt mining industry because it feeds their batteries, but they won't do anything about it, right? So if you really want to take responsibility, in my humble opinion, it has to start with the board and the CEOs of brands, especially in four industries, right? Circular packaging, fashion, mining, and agriculture. Because yes, the governments do their thing, the NGOs do their thing, but at the end of the day, the brands drive billions or trillions of dollars of commerce, which directly touches to the raw materials, finished goods that are produced by the poorest people in the world. So in my opinion, it's not just taking that responsibility seriously, but saying we want a profitable supply chain, but it has to be driven by purpose. And the easiest example I use is that today the CEO of AB InBev, Carlos Brito, can look up on his phone and say, I can tell you if that mama recycler in Bogota, on the streets of Bogota, got paid for the 40 bottles she picked up. If you can't name your mama farmer and you can't name your mama waste picker, then don't say you're doing responsibly, you're sourcing responsibly, or you have a responsible business. That's just fake then. Over.
Thank you for that, Ashish. And some really great, powerful examples there. I think, Ben, you can agree with me that it's really inspiring to hear that these problems are existing, but the solutions are happening around us, right?
Absolutely. Vera, Ashish has just spoken about sourcing responsibly. What is extended producer responsibility, and how will that change production?
So extended producer responsibility, that entails a policy approach whereby producers are given an extensive responsibility for the products post-consumption. So that could be either in a financial form or also in a physical shape. So the financial form is that they're essentially taxed for using materials that don't stand the test of time or that are particularly harmful for the environment. In a physical shape or form, that could be if they actually have to take back the product. So the OECD, so the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, they've extensively worked on this. And I think that this is a very interesting kind of policy that has a lot of scope for success. I see some problematic elements in this, and this is because I think it is very easy for extended producer responsibility to nonetheless pass the onus onto the consumer once again. So that onus could, for instance, take the shape of higher prices for goods, or also how easy is it to return a good at the end of a life cycle? Say, if it's just simply not convenient to do so, we were talking about new parents, for instance, earlier, nappies, etc. So when it's simply not convenient to return a product, and most of consumption is also about convenience, then it can't work. Then it's not a closed system, like the cradle-to-cradle system, for instance, is. So also, I don't think that it can actually curtail pollution from products that are then potentially shipped off to the global south, because it depends, of course, on the on the recycling systems they have in place. However, we're often really quick to say, the global north is so much more advanced. They have such better recycling systems. And that is not necessarily true. In the global south, there are also incredible recycling systems in their own right. Once again, Adam Minter has actually looked at that in great detail. He's also looked at e-waste and done some impressive work on that I can recommend. But the problem is that often it will be down to unsafe labor standards once again. So if you go, for instance, to a dump in Bangladesh, you will find people, also children, who will pick apart. It's like in a really impressive recycling system in its own right, and that these people will pick apart things and recycle it to the max. They've got the highest recycling rate in the world, but of course it also comes at the expense of the people who work there.
Yeah. Vera, I think Brendan has something to say. Brendan, you want to hop in?
Yeah, no, great points there, Vera. Thank you for those mentions of the responsibility of extended producers, manufacturing behavior and post-use behavior. I think some of the critical elements in terms of what we're dealing with, as you say, is you know, what happens after the thing is utilized or so forth. I just want to augment something here in terms of the language we use. It's a very cradle-to-cradle kind of perspective. We don't really use the words life cycle analysis because, you know, I would say 99% of the products we use are not living, you know. So we look at it as a use cycle analysis. And once we start aligning that with the perspective of the cradle-to-cradle and circular economy lens, we tend to see folks wanting to retain the value of their hard-earned time, effort, and mining, and all of that sort of thing. So, you know, when you extract materials and create things, there's a lot of work and money spent on doing those things. Now, the clever thing and the business kind of strategy with that is to be able to retain the value of those things. So, for example, I'll use the Wonderween again. That plastic thing that is made, that our friend Lindsay is producing, that is circulated amongst, let's call it, anything between 3 to 5 families who are weaning babies. So there's a social share platform that this item can be circulated amongst 3 to 5 families globally. So wherever that supply chain is needed, right at the end of its use, that particular item gets reclaimed by Lindsay's company and gets repelletized again. So you're using 98% of the materials, and then it's shipped back out into the market. So just to kind of have a positive perspective in terms of the extended producer responsibility, I think it's valuable to know that we need to retain the values or value of the materials we're producing and manufacturing.
No, and thank you for that, Brendan. I think you're right. It is very important and sometimes also challenging because, you know, it's not always easy to convince the investors and government to only look at the profit, that there is this intrinsic value and retaining it as long as possible. But that's what we're all here to do, to change that mindset and to show that the value does continue. Vera, I want to come back to you and follow up on, you know, the global North-South discussion. Products that are built for the global north sometimes, you know, like let's look at like a lot of these high-end manufactured goods, but end up in the global south after they're no longer useful or fashionable. We can look at clothing, we can look at electronics, two areas which you've looked into extensively. Will extended producer responsibility be able to curtail that?
I think that's a very good question. It very much depends on the local frameworks that are in place. But first of all, I wanted to say that these goods often have a very, very long use cycle. And I really appreciate Brendan's rephrasing of that. I think it makes a lot more sense. So they still have a long use cycle ahead of them. So for instance, Fairphone produces phones that have double SIMs because that will have a higher use value in the global south. So after people are finished using their phones in the global north, sometimes they get shipped off into the global south and still have use value there. Another example, of course, would be cars. A lot of cars that, say, in Germany, you can hardly see on the street still, they make their way, say, to Kazakhstan, etc. And they're driven there for a long time still, and they will be repaired for much longer than in Germany they may be. Another example are actually car seats. Adam Minter talks about car seats, just to mention his name again. And car seats are one of those goods where you're not supposed to use them secondhand, right? Unless you know the person who's used the car seat and trust that person beforehand. But car seats for children are actually a really great example how things that are practically designed for the dump in the global north still find a lot of use value in the global south. So for instance, car seats that are no longer in use in United States of America are then passed on to consumers in Mexico, etc. So there is a lot of use value that can still be gained out of a lot of products, also fashion, say. But yes, so I would really question to what extent extended producer responsibility can work if there are no local frameworks in place, if the local governments don't actually also pull up those same multi-conglomerates. So that means that it can't only be countries in, roughly speaking, of course, I mean, it's slightly colonial thinking that's on right, you know, saying in the global north, let's say, you are responsible for those goods that you turn out. It also has to be governments in the global south. But I really think it's less kind of electronic goods and it's less fashion, although those are also huge contributors to waste. It is a lot of the fast-moving consumer goods that really pose the problem. So, for instance, John Sutherland from A Plastic Planet, in an earlier discussion group hosted by you, also said about how, for instance, Procter & Gamble, they issue all of these detergents, etc. They issue them in sachet size. So all of these sachets, all of those wrappers, you know, for ice cream, etc., all of those fast-moving consumer goods, they are a massive problem. And this is where I'd really like to see extended producer responsibility just be worked a lot harder than it currently is.
No, absolutely. Ashish, why don't you share your thoughts? I know you want to add something here.
One quick example, right, that I've seen it personally in the last 6 years, spent a lot of time in Africa specifically, which is around the buy one, give one, right? And honestly, I absolutely hate it. So, you know, if you look at here in the U.S., where I am right now, people have this, you buy a pair of shoe, and then some kid in Haiti gets a pair of shoe, or some kid in Congo gets a pair of shoe. And I think that actually completely destroys the local economies. And I saw this firsthand when I was in Congo. A truck will show up with a bunch of free shoes, and, you know, a family here in Austin, Texas, feels great that they bought four pairs of shoes for their kid, and four kids in Africa got free pairs of shoes. But they're missing the point. They're missing the point that, A, when these free shoes show up in Africa, you've destroyed the local business. You know that the kids' feet are going to grow. So what are you going to do now? You're going to supply shoes for the rest of their lives. You're creating this dependency. And third, and most importantly, it is this greenwash element that I've spoken before, right? Because we love to check off the box here in the North saying, oh, we're doing good in the world, but we have no idea what we're doing to local economies and creating this absolute pity lens and dependence. And I think we need to break that. We need to get rid of the buy one, give one free. Over.
Thank you for that, Ashish. And I think you're right. It is about changing the mindset and also the systems. And wow, there's so much to still talk about. I think, Ben, you it's time for you to, like, you know, bring up another segment of the challenges, and maybe the challenges some of our producers or US solution makers are facing.
There is, Rami. Brendan, Ashish, what about pushback? Have you experienced this?
Yeah, good question, and quite topical. I think it isn't easy. It's very difficult to, like I mentioned before, to incorporate the right partners to develop a cradle-to-cradle certified product or a circular economy ready product. And in fact, yesterday, having this other podcast that we were on, Matt Paskin from Whitecroft Lighting mentioned the fact that they'd lost a lot of their supply chain due to the fact that they wanted to dive into the cradle-to-cradle certification process, and they had to, they lost some old friends, and they had to make new friends to develop this. So the pushback in terms of taking responsibility for a lot of the challenges that we are facing in becoming better or more good is very prevalent. It's not easy to change, and particularly in countries like the UK and sometimes the States, the northern global guys are probably a little bit less, a little bit less comfortable with making changes to their business models.
Yeah. So,
the agility of being able to adapt to the demands that we are now looking to adopt. Mentioning Africa and South America and Asia, there's a level of agility that those territories seem to have kind of one-upman in terms of comparisons. So the business models need to be augmented to align with designing things differently. And I think that the best way to approach that is just education, and as I said before, no one's going out there to plan to do bad. They just don't know about what is good. So I think the education in terms of that is quite critical.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Education is fundamental there. And I think that's something that we need to definitely ensure that we have more of and increase access to that. Ashish, what about yourself? I know you've definitely had your challenges along the way. Do you want to share some of the biggest ones and the biggest pushbacks you faced?
Absolutely. Every day is like climbing Mount Everest for us, but we're on the challenge. The number one challenge we face is where, you know, brands or even, you know, just having conversation, people would say, you know, these poor farmers or these waste pickers, you know, they have literacy issues and how can they handle new technology? And I really get mad about it. And I truly take offense because I've never met a mama farmer or a mama recycler who is not smarter than me. Because these women, especially women, right, and men too, are extremely smart and diligent, and they've seen adversity, right? So I think the number one challenge is changing kind of the first world's perception that poor people are not smart or literate. So that's number one. Number two is, you know, the brands, when they want to do something and then they shove it into a corporate social responsibility bucket, right? It's that greenwash element is a challenge. And the third one, which is so dear to my heart, is the data ownership. You know, and I take offense myself because when in my past life, when I was doing startups, I made a lot of money on other people's data, right? It's the classic Facebook way. But over the last 6 years, I've realized that's absolutely the wrong way, because people in that last mile, first mile should have absolutely the ability to own their data, access their data, permission their data, and monetize their data. And we need to respect that. And that's the reason why we went down the blockchain path, because we don't want to use other people's data to get rich. We want that mama farmer to say, hey, I own my data and I exist in your supply chain, right? And that third challenge is a big one because, you know, at least from a systems thinking perspective, everybody makes money on somebody else's data and that somebody else loses out. So in my opinion, that is a top challenge that brands or technology companies have to learn to give up, because that farmer has the right to own their data.
Thank you for that. And I think it's really interesting you talk about owning your data, because it is a common trend nowadays you see with so many, especially tech companies, and their main players. Oh, I'm going to make this big business because I've got the data, I've got the data, I've got the data. And I really like how you're switching that around and saying, yes, it's not about using their data, but giving them ownership of the data, giving the people who need that data the ownership of it. So I really like that, Ashish.
Yes. So let's just go around the table. Starting with you, Brendan, what is something that you are excited about in production for the future?
I must say I'm generally a positive person anyway. So there's a lot to be excited about and positive about. I could mention a whole bunch of examples, but I think one of the most really cool things that we're personally doing as a company is engaging the Environment Agency here in the UK to start looking at adopting the cradle-to-cradle certified products into some of their projects. That's a big, you know, it's a big plus for us and for, you know, society in general. I think policymakers need to acknowledge the fact that there are good solutions to some of the issues that we're dealing with. I think that's one of the biggest, most exciting and positive things that are happening for us at the moment.
Oh, excellent. Thank you for sharing that. Vera, what are you most excited about?
I'm really excited about the fact that zero waste is becoming more and more part of the mainstream now, that online providers of goods are also going increasingly zero waste. For instance, I'm thinking about the Good Club, which is a provider of, like, it's almost like an online supermarket for stockpiling. And they're increasingly going down the zero waste route. And very recently, I was able to received their first shipment where almost all of the goods were zero waste goods. And that really excites me.
Thank you for that, Vera. And I'm getting really excited. You guys have made me feel positive despite an episode where we talked about so many challenges that we face. Ashish, what about yourself? What are you excited about for the future, except for expanding BankQ?
You know, great question. I think what I'm really positive about is that there are technologies available today. Where technology is not the answer, but it is breaking down the barrier, right? And, you know, I used to be a big believer that technology is like internet got to people in poverty, or mobile money got to people in poverty, but didn't enable them out of poverty. But over the last 4 or 5 years, just, you know, using our example, we've seen that it can, right? If you use it the right way, you can enable people out of poverty. so that, you know, that mama farmer, that mama recycler can say, I exist. And that's all they need to break through the cycle of extreme poverty or child labor and gender equality. So I have a lot of hope for that.
No, you know what? It's really exciting. And, you know, it got me thinking, and I was so excited to kind of come to the close, but I had to ask one more question to all three of you, just because we are going to be doing a whole episode on the circular economy in two or three episodes time. But before we do that, I just wanted to get your thoughts on how you think we can shift our production system. I know it's a big question, but it'd be really interesting to get that, because I was just thinking, wow, you guys have shared so many interesting ideas and there's so much positivity here. Let's end with a big positive statement how we can shift it. Why don't we start with Brendan?
It is a big question, and I'm not sure I have the answer, but I think for all the efforts that we're all doing in this arena, I would say the most effective way of addressing all of that would be to educate, you know, because information and knowledge, be free with your knowledge and engage, you know, the youngsters, the students at universities are the ones that are asking the questions. And I think education is going to be critical to trickle down all of the expertise that we've all learned currently. So, yeah, I think that's it. Education is the key.
Absolutely. And that's a running theme I'm sure we're going to see throughout the episode. What about yourself, Vera? What do you think? How can we shift our production system?
I would also like to believe that education is the key, as I'm an educator myself. And in addition to that, when it comes to production lines, very practically, I'd like to say, with every item of packaging, really think about it. Like, is that packaging needed? Is that layer needed? And to just kind of strip away from the packaging materials as much as possible.
Thank you very much. And that's really important. I guess all these things are going to add up. Last but not least, Ashish, what would you like to see? And how do you think we can shift our production system?
I think it's a simple question that CEOs need to ask themselves is, can I name one waste picker on the streets of Lusaka that is picking up my plastic can that I put out in the market? If I cannot answer that question, then I have a lot of work to do.
That was fantastic. And the best thing is that I'm feeling optimistic despite the many challenges ahead of us. There is no doubt that we must transform the production ecosystem and do it fast. At the same time, we must be uncompromising. Firstly, producers need to assess the materials that go into and package products and think about their value after they have been purchased. Secondly, producers have to notice the people along the supply chain. Human rights mean fair compensation, being able to work with dignity, and turning the data supply chain on its head. Production should lead to social upliftment. Lastly, accountability matters. Producers must stamp out greenwashing before it becomes pervasive. Today's leaders must act, not just talk. So thank you to Brendan, Vera, and Ashish for your time. I really enjoyed this episode and look forward to our next one, where we'll be talking about consumerism from the consumer's point of view. This is one half of your co-host, Rami Samaria, signing out.
And this is the other half, Ben Joseph. All the best to you.
Thank you once again for listening to the Oblique Life Global Goals podcast. If you enjoyed today's session, please do like, follow, and share it with your friends, family, and colleagues.
That's right. We need to discuss these topics and share solutions. So as Rami said, please do follow us, like our episodes, but also share any questions or comments you have, and we will get back to you.
We want to spark discussion and want all of you to be part of it. From the Oblique Life and all of our partners, thanks for tuning in, and hope to have you join in our next episode.